court did not issue any order to take Ms. Fulton to custody or detain her or have her go hospitalization for any reason.
Questions over the origins of a court order for a mental health check, the courts say, never existed. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, January 25th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, the story of two Russians who crossed the Bering Sea in a fishing boat to avoid the war in Ukraine.
And can you imagine, these are two men who have left everything behind in Russia. They've left their lives behind.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The future looks bright because the University of Alaska is on a mission to empower Alaska. From drone piloting to vital climate research to critical mining solutions, the University of Alaska's three universities and their community campuses shape the jobs and careers that fuel the economy, creating a more empowered Alaska for all. Learn more at empower.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
The largest national forest in the United States is once again protected from development under the roadless rule. The United States Department of Agriculture announced today it had restored roadless protections to nearly 10 million acres of the Tongass National Forest, which spans most of southeast Alaska. In a press release, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack said the Tongass is key to conserving biodiversity and addressing the climate crisis, adding that the decision listened to the requests of Alaska Native tribes and people of southeast, while also recognizing the importance of fishing and tourism to the region's economy. The agency said in a press release it received more than 100,000 public comments in the two-month period after it began the process to get the roadless rule back in place, and the majority were in favor. The roadless rule was put in place at the end of the Clinton administration in 2001 and prevented road construction, reconstruction, and timber harvest in most areas of the Tongass and many other national forests. But under the Trump administration, more than half of the national forest had been removed from roadless rule protection. Tribes and environmental groups in southeast Alaska quickly sued, saying the decision disregarded overwhelming opposition. Throughout the last two decades, multiple Alaska governors and members of the state's congressional delegation have pushed back against the rule, saying it hampers resource development and economic growth in the state. The Anchorage Assembly took the extraordinary step of compelling testimony from a member of Mayor Dave Bronson's administration on Tuesday. This subpoena is part of the Assembly's follow-up on how the former head of the city's health department was hired with a fabricated resume. As Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early reports, it's the latest in a string of controversies plaguing Bronson's administration that the mayor won't talk about publicly.
For months, the Assembly says it asked for a briefing from the administration on the hiring, investigation, and eventual termination last August of former health director Joe Gerace. Then on Monday, the Assembly unanimously passed a resolution granting the Assembly chair subpoena power in connection with Gerace. Assembly Vice Chair Chris Constant said it was difficult but necessary.
This is a serious action. We've had counsel reviewing and couldn't find any record of this type of action before. And thus, this is an unprecedented action.
The Assembly and mayor have feuded over numerous issues since Bronson took office in the summer of 2021, and the Gerace hiring is one of several issues boiling over right now. Assembly Chair Suzanne LaFrance subpoenaed the municipality's Chief Human Resources Officer Nikki Chebaka to testify about Gerace Tuesday night. Members met with Chebaka for over 2 hours in a closed executive session. Still, when the private meeting wrapped, members like Meg Zalatel said they felt they didn't learn anything new.
The reason we went into executive session was there was an expectation that government records that were to be kept confidential were to be provided. I don't think that expectation was necessarily met.
She proposed releasing the tape of the meeting to the public. But attorneys with the municipal law department said Chebaka's report is confidential. Assembly Counsel Dean Gates said that means it could be legally tricky to release the footage.
I would not recommend releasing the tapes of our discussion and our consideration of the document until the document or is actually released or no longer subject to a privilege.
A majority of assembly members disagreed, arguing that the information in the document was already public knowledge. The body voted 7-4 in favor of releasing the footage. The tapes have yet to be released as of the recording of this story. Tuesday night's assembly meeting was also the first regular meeting since ousted municipal manager Amy Demboski issued a scathing letter alleging unethical and unlawful actions by Bronson's team. Bronson has remained silent about the allegations since they became public 2 weeks ago, citing advice from city lawyers. Near the start of the meeting, LaFrance asked Bronson to address the claims, as well as to address the investigation of Gerace.
Since this issue is so serious, I wanted to extend to you an opportunity for a moment of privilege to respond to our community regarding the growing concerns of financial and employment mismanagement, as well as the results of the Gerace investigation. If you would like to speak to that now, the floor is yours.
Bronson only responded to the question of Gerace's records.
HR records are a private affair, and we are required by law to not divulge HR records, whether it's Mr. Gerace or anyone else. And that was, I believe, explained to you by Blair Christensen as well. So I'll leave it at that.
During the meeting, city officials sent an email announcing that Christensen resigned from her position as acting municipal attorney effective February 8th for a new job. Meanwhile, LaFrance told Bronson he has a standing invitation to address Demboski's claims. With help from Jeremy Shea, reporting in Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
The search for the second snow machiner who set out from Kotzebue on a trip to Norvik more than a week ago is over. Alaska state troopers say Thomas Brown did not survive. Searchers found Brown's body about 10 and a half miles from Kotzebue near Cape Blossom. Brown and his friend Josiah Ballett, both 18 years old, had messaged friends that they were traveling to Norvik on Monday, January 16th. Ballett was found last Friday about 28 miles south of Kotzebue, hunkered down next to a ridge of sea ice, which offered some protection from the wind. But Ballett did not escape severe frostbite and was medevaced to Anchorage for treatment. Alaska state troopers made a mistake when they took Mary Fulp, the state's 2022 Principal of the Year, into custody last week for an involuntary mental health evaluation under what is now described as a false court order. That's according to the Department of Public Safety and the Alaska court system as first reported by the Alaska Beacon. Fulp is the former principal of Colony Middle School and the current principal of Colony High School, located side by side in Palmer. Fulp had expressed having a profound religious experience in a more than three-hour Facebook Live video January 15th. She live-streamed again on January 18th when two troopers came to her home, telling her that they had a court order signed by a judge that said she had to undergo a mental health evaluation. In the video, which remained publicly viewable today, Fulp gently argues with the troopers.
What am I getting taken to the hospital?
Yes, ma'am.
I'm getting taken to the hospital for claiming that Jesus is king, and claiming that I stand with the Martin Luther King civil rights movement. So I would like this to show up in the news and for this to go viral, because I am the 2022 Alaska Principal of the Year who loves Jesus with all her heart.
Fulp eventually complied and went with the troopers to Mat-Su Regional Hospital, but the order apparently presented to the troopers by a family member was not valid according to state officials.
The court did not issue any order to take Ms. Fulp into custody or detain her or have her go hospitalization for any reason.
That's Rebecca Coford, a spokesperson for the state court system. Coford says normally law enforcement officers like the troopers in the Fulp incident would get an order directly from the court after a judge signed it.
We send them directly to law enforcement. If a family member is a petitioner, then they would get a copy of the court order because they're the petitioner. Right, so they might have a copy, but we send them directly to law enforcement.
That's not what happened with Fulp, though. According to the Department of Public Safety, someone presented the troopers with an order that was alleged to have been signed by a judge. Department spokesperson Austin McDaniel says the troopers did, in fact, look at the document, and it did appear to have been signed by a judge. Seeming to disagree with Coford, McDaniels says troopers are sometimes made aware of court orders from someone involved in a civil issue, for example, in incidents that occur after hours when the courts are closed. Still, Public Safety Commissioner Jim Cockrell says in a statement, quote, "Our staff should have taken additional steps to verify the information presented by the complainant and the validity of the court order," end quote. Cockrell has requested a full review of the incident to ensure something similar does not happen again in the future. Fulp did not respond to requests for comments sent on Facebook and to her school email address. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Alaska Long Trail is a long ways off, but supporters say the benefits are worth the wait.
Their economic impact has the chance to be both deeper and wider in one community.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Are you an Alaska artist or do you know one? March 1st is the deadline to apply for a Rasmussen Foundation Individual Artist Award. The program provides awards to artists, musicians, performers, writers, and culture bearers. Amounts are increasing. A project award, now $10,000, is available for an Alaska artist at any career stage. Mid-career and established artists may apply for a $25,000 artist fellowship. Learn more at Rasmussen.org. Rasmussen Foundation, promoting a better life for all Alaskans. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
Remember the two Russian men who fled to Alaska in a 16-foot fishing boat to avoid being drafted to fight in Ukraine? Well, after their arrival in the St. Lawrence Island village of Gamble in October, they spent 3 months in detention and bailed out earlier this month in Washington State. That's where Charlie McCann, a feature writer for The Economist's long-form magazine 1843, caught up with them. McCann has written a detailed account of why and how Sergei and Maxim escaped Russia to seek asylum and new lives in the United States.
Both of them said to me that, you know, why are we there? What is the point of this war? So many people are dying. And they both used that word, evil. They said, you know, this is evil. You know, Sergei in particular, he's very outspoken. He tells me that he was arrested in June and detained for a couple of days. Once he was detained by the government and warned in this way, he decided, right, I've got to leave. I've got to leave this country. And then a month later, conscription began. Military officers began knocking on the doors of men in his town, trying to haul them off to Ukraine. And so Sergei and Maxim both got that knock on the door. Neither of them answered that knock on the door, because if they had, they would have been sent packing to the front. And I think it was that knock on the door that made Sergei realize now is the time.
Well, you know, I guess we know that they made it at this point, but tell me about their journey. I mean, what was that like? I mean, how did they survive crossing the Bering Sea?
It was nerve-wracking. For so many reasons, right? So they set off going down the Chukotka Peninsula. And so they were worried about being discovered, you know, found out by the people in these towns. They always stuck to the same story, which was that they were looking for dead walruses so that they could remove the tusks and sell them. And then, of course, they were like constantly terrified of being found out by the border patrol. This is like a really heavily militarized part of Russia, towns kind of crawling with border patrol. And then the other huge concern, of course, was just like dealing with the sea. You know, the first day or two was smooth sailing, but they encountered storms. There was one particularly terrifying moment on their fifth and final day of this voyage. And can you imagine, these are two men who have left everything behind in Russia. They've left their lives behind, everything they know, everyone they know, to strike out and try to make new lives in America, if only they can make it there. And by this point, they are so close. And then Sergei, he sees these enormous waves. They start to feel the wind. They see the waters getting choppier. They pull out their weather app and they see the cyclone is right there. They're heading right for it. They didn't even think about returning to shore. This might be their last chance to make it to the U.S. And so they just persisted. You know, the water got rougher and rougher. There was a moment when Sergei said it felt as if they were between two walls of water. The waves were that big. And yet they survived because Maxim, you know, spent so much of his life in the water. He's a really deft boatsman. And he just managed to ensure that they sort of skirted the cyclone. They're never pulled in too far into the eye of the storm. And somehow they made it.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, they showed up in Alaska, and this is St. Lawrence Island, the little village of Gamble. How were they welcomed? And then how did that welcoming party sort of change pretty quickly, it sounded like?
Yeah, well, they said it was at first a little bit tense, kind of understandably so, because they're wearing their camo jackets. And apparently a bunch of locals had gathered on the beach to check out what was going on. And apparently they wondered, oh, God, are these guys Russian soldiers? But, you know, Sergei and Maxim quickly explained the situation. They were communicating via Google Translate and said, no, we're definitely not Russian soldiers. We're actually here because we're trying to escape the Russian military. We're here to declare asylum. And, you know, I think, you know, at that point, they were welcomed by the locals. They fed them, and I think Sergei and Maxim apparently tried to return the favor. They had brought so much food with them that there was kind of a bit of an exchange of food. And at some point, ICE got involved as well. But I think they were helicoptered out of Gambel by the Coast Guard and deposited in Anchorage, where ICE took over.
I got the impression, too, that they were obviously very happy to have made the crossing alive and to make it to the United States and to try to start this new life here. But things are a little different now than they were when people were defecting from the Soviet Union, right? And so tell me about the rest of their journey to the point where you actually had a chance to talk to them, because they spent quite a bit of time in detention, right?
Yeah, they were very surprised. I think they were probably expecting some bureaucracy, of course, but they weren't expecting what happened. And what happened was they were taken into ICE custody and they were flown from Anchorage to Tacoma, Washington, where they were put in a detention facility. They were detained for 3 months in conditions which sound pretty miserable. They were in one very large room with about 70 other detainees. The food was pretty miserable. They said it was rice and beans and beans and rice pretty much the whole time.
Well, yeah. So they bail out, and then you flew out to Washington to talk to them. What was that like? And I guess also, I mean, what did they say about their hopes for the future?
When I met them, Sergei had been out for all of 5 days, and Maxim was released just the day before. They were really acclimating both to being in the U.S., but also to being free after this 3-month ordeal. But I think they're just, yeah, they're basically kind of getting their feet on the ground. You know, Sergei, he's a really dynamic, energetic guy. And he basically he's thinking about the next steps, thinking about what jobs he might do in the U.S. Maxim, he'd only been out for a day, so I think he was still kind of collecting himself. But I asked him, you know, what do you think you might want to do? And he said that he is hoping to be reunited with his fishing boat.
A true fisherman.
Yeah, exactly.
They also said something about wanting to come back to Alaska, didn't they?
Sergei said, look, we're people of the North. We're used to the Arctic climate. And so their thought initially had been that they would return to Anchorage. I think Maxim still felt that he would. And Sergei, you know, being a real entrepreneurial type, was thinking maybe Anchorage, but that also he would see, you know, he would go wherever sort of supply and demand, as he put it, would take him.
That was Charlie McCann, a feature writer for The Economist's long-form magazine 1843. You can find her story about the two Russian men who fled to Alaska last fall to escape the war in Ukraine at economist.com/1843.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing cargo transportation to 9 Alaska communities. NAC offers options including cargo charters to get freight where it needs to be. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. The future looks bright because the University of Alaska is on a mission to empower Alaska. From drone piloting to vital climate research to critical mining solutions, the University of Alaska's 3 universities and their community campuses shape the jobs and careers that fuel the economy, creating a more empowered Alaska for all. Learn more at empower.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
Congresswoman Mary Peltola says she's not exactly sure why her online biography shows she attended a Colorado university a year longer than she did.
Well, it's really embarrassing, and I think it's probably my error.
Her congressional biography page shows she attended University of Northern Colorado from 1991 until 1994. So does her biography on the website of the Alaska Legislature, where she served for a decade. But the university says she left in spring of 1993. The discrepancy came to light last week because USA Today decided to see if other freshman Congress members lied about their educational background the way New York Congressman George Santos did. Her case is unlike that of Santos, though. For one, she never pretended to have a college degree. But she says when you're in the public eye, every part of your life is examined.
And I think that's fine. That's as it should be. If you're in public service, that is the cost of service.
In other Peltola news, her office announced today that she's won a seat on the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee. The panel oversees the nation's highways, air travel, and shipping. It also sets policy on pipelines, emergency response, and the Coast Guard. Among the Alaska issues that come up in that committee are a passenger air subsidy called Essential Air Service, icebreaker acquisition, and matters related to the Army Corps of Engineers. Peltola's predecessor, the late Congressman Don Young, was a member of the committee and served as its chairman. The Sitka Assembly is moving forward with plans to donate $25,000 to the Alaska Trollers Association to support the organization's ongoing legal fight against a Washington environmental group that hopes to shut down commercial fishing for king salmon in southeast Alaska. And other organizations and locals are piling on in anticipation of a lengthy and costly appeals process. KCAW's Catherine Rose reports.
Alaska Trollers and the Alaska Department of Fish and Game intervened in a lawsuit against the National Marine Fisheries Service brought by the Wild Fish Conservancy in 2020. The Duval, Washington-based group argues that commercial trolling in Alaska threatens an endangered population of killer whales in Puget Sound by depriving them of king salmon, their primary food source, and they've been successful in court. In December, a U.S. District Court judge issued a report that, to make a long story short, puts the Southeast King salmon fishery at risk of closure. And that means a bigger hole in the Troll Association's pocket as it anticipates a lengthy appeals process. In early January, trollers drummed up support at the Sitka Assembly table. And at its January 24th meeting, more came out of the woodwork in support of the organization. Roger Hames of Hames Corporation, which owns a major grocery store in Sitka, said he'd been asked to contribute $5,000, but he'd likely contribute $10,000. Tad Fujioka is chairman of the board for Seafood Producers Co-op. He said the Alaska Trollers Association had requested around $48,000 from SPC, but employees asked them to donate more money from their profit-sharing pool.
Even though ATA only asked for $48,500, the SPC board voted to contribute $59,000. It's an investment in our company's future. We can't afford to lose access to troll salmon, and neither can Sitka. So I encourage the Assembly to be similarly farsighted and make this investment alongside your citizen fishermen.
And Jackie Foss said it's not just fishermen who've contributed to the trollers' cause. The ATA is receiving a lot of individual donations and contributions from municipalities like Craig, Port Alexander, and Pelican.
I feel super just grateful to live in a place where everyone's rallying around small boat fishermen. And so I know Sitka's the biggest and it's the most, and our ask might feel like a lot, but a third of the fleet is here. And donations, people give what they can. And small communities give what they can, and bigger communities with most of the fleet give what they feel is appropriate too.
Most assembly members said they'd support a $25,000 donation to the legal fund, and some said they'd be open to contributing beyond that amount in the future. Assemblymember Tim Pike said he wanted to redirect the conversation around why the contribution was necessary.
As I heard it here a couple of times tonight, you know, trollers paid a bunch of taxes, so we owe it to them. I don't see it that way. I see it as a community investment. I see it as coming out of all of our pockets. I see it as something for all of us to contribute to. I don't see it as the trollers have earned this, okay? You've earned it because you are Sitkins and you're part of our economy. But I think it belongs to all of us. It doesn't just belong to the trollers.
Municipal Administrator John Leach said they'd be putting more resources towards supporting the ATA in the suit by working with Alaska's congressional delegation. He said city staff and lobbyists had a meeting with staff from Senators Murkowski and Sullivan and from Representative Peltola's office last week to discuss options.
It was reiterated by all staff members on the call that it's a very important issue for all three members of the delegation. They've found legal counsel with MSA and the Salmon Treaty expertise to assist them and are coordinating with each other regarding a possible amicus brief that they could file jointly with the court, and said they intend to circulate a draft internally among themselves as early as this week.
Along with a separate resolution supporting the Southeast Troll Fishery, the Assembly approved the $25,000 donation unanimously. The ordinance will come before the Assembly for a final reading at the next regular meeting on February 14th. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Catherine Rose.
A 500-mile-long trail connecting the Kenai Peninsula to Fairbanks is in the works, and organizers say it has the potential to create big economic impacts in the communities it runs through. The idea of a so-called Alaska Long Trail has been around for a long time, but really picked up steam in 2019, according to Haley Johnston with Alaska Trails, the coordinating organization for the project.
It's also being driven by this coalition of people who are along the trail corridors. It's a group of people from across the state who are making decisions and trying to push this thing forward.
The long trail will be open to a variety of recreation types. Johnston says those use modes will vary along the trail. Johnston says 20% of the route already exists as trails with their own restrictions, and that work on the trail will happen in pieces.
As a whole, I think the Alaska Long Trail will be great, but independently, each of these trail projects is worthy of its funding.
The organizations working on the trail are getting piecemeal funding for each part of the project. During the last legislative session, several of these projects connected to the Long Trail had big financial wins, including $1.5 million allotted to the Crow Pass to Eagle River Trail. Johnston says prospective Long Trail hikers could have a big dollar impact per person. Trail hikers are more likely to spend at local businesses, restaurants, and lodging locations, she says. Johnston says realistically, it will take about 5 years for the trail between Seward and the Mat-Su to be complete. Everything north of there will take a while longer, she says. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We're also on Spotify now. We had reports tonight from Sage Smiley in Wrangell, Wesley Early, Jeremy Shea, and Rhonda McBride in Anchorage, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Catherine Rose in Sitka, and Riley Board in Kenai. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde. Madeline Rose is our producer. And I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
My home far away. And driving down the road, I get the feeling that I should have been home yesterday. Yesterday. Country roads.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil exploration and production, and working to create economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources.
And by
the Westmark Fairbanks Hotel and Conference Center, located in downtown Fairbanks, featuring hot breakfast, Wi-Fi, and a fitness center. Reservations at westmarkhotels.com.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.